Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Box Trek. I'm your host, Matt Brady, joined today by Jake James Lugo. JJ, I've seen you over on TikTok, man. Loving all the stuff. I then followed you on YouTube and everything, and you're just like cranking out content. So How is it going, man?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. Nice to meet you, to chat with you like this. I think it's cool because I've seen you. Obviously, I've watched your stuff on TikTok because, again, when we're scrolling through the For You page, stuff, things just pop up. And sometimes you just start interacting with people. You start liking stuff and it just kind of just grows on you over time. Yeah. So this is fun. This is cool. It's great. It's great to meet more people within our space, you know, and just to like interact in a fun way rather than just the craziness of social media.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, TikTok is such a wild... it's like the Wild West out there still, you know. Facts, it's just like you like something and then suddenly the next thing you know, everybody's just popping up in your feed and I'm just seeing it. And I'm just like, man, I look on your TikTok page and you're just cranking out videos, but like all sorts of stuff. And I'm like, wow, he does not, you're talking about retro and all this stuff. And I was like, we have a lot of the same interests and everything. So I was like, I got to reach out and just wanted to see if he'd come on and we can chat some games and just whatever. So however it goes. So what we're going to be doing today is just what I call game chat, where we're just going to talk about three games that we're just playing or have played recently. Can be any game, sort of what we're playing, maybe what we're enjoying, you know, just whatever. So I'll go first, just sort of kick it off here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is the year for Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. Yeah. And so my goal was to go back and replay all the Zeldas in order to get ready. And I started that journey at the beginning of last year. That didn't happen. but I did get through.
What's that plan?
That did not happen, but I have gotten through a couple of them. And oddly, the one I'm going to talk about today, which I sort of finished maybe like a few weeks ago, was A Link to the Past.
Solid game.
It's like, I've talked a lot about Zelda on my channel and on TikTok and everything, but it's so weird because I missed A Link to the Past growing up. Right. I would say that my journey with Zelda really sort of started it actually started with Zelda 2, although I really had no idea that that's what it was, because Zelda 2 is like its own
An anomaly in the series. It's like the black sheep of the whole series.
So I remember playing this game, like Legend Zelda 2 on the NES, you know, like my cousin's house, my aunt's house, something like that, and not really thinking anything more about it. I had no idea what Zelda 1 was. It's, you know, before the internet. It's the 90s.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the N64 came out, and I didn't have an N64 initially. I was a PlayStation guy. And so I remember going over to one of my buddy's house, and we were playing Smash Brothers. Mm-hmm. And there was this character in it who I was using. And I was like, who's this guy? And he had, because I was a Sega kid too. So Sega, then to PlayStation. So I wasn't as big into Nintendo. And his name was Link. And I was like, okay, cool. And then they had a little section where you could go and look up information onto who these
tell you what's up,
tell you what games they were in, even on the one from the N64. I was like, oh, this is that guy from Zelda 2. Well, that's cool. So I totally skipped Link the Past. And then Ocarina of Time came out and Majora's Mask and everything. Yeah. But for just whatever reason, you know, I played Link's Awakening. I just never went back and played A Link to the Past. Mm. So I played like all the other Zeldas, just for whatever reason. So having gone back and played it sort of recently, man, like ashamed at myself for having missed, you know, A Link to the Past growing up, because there's so much about it that I get now. And it's almost, I almost have this like sense of loss having played it, not for the first time, but really like diving in, just playing it sort of without a guide, just to really sort of dive in and experience it for what it is. And of course, I now have the advantage of having played so many other Zelda games that I'm much more familiar than if I had played it when it initially came out and it was would have been new. But man, it's just sort of this like sense of loss of like, wow, I really think I would have enjoyed this as a kid, you know, back when you didn't have responsibilities and didn't have all these things.
Simpler time.
You could just in the summer, you know, play games. And so, yeah. So now that's just kind of where I'm at. So I'm guessing you've obviously played.
Yes.
Played it. Yeah.
So I reviewed it a while back on my YouTube channel, because at some point I went back to the older Zelda games. I did Zelda, the original NES Zelda. I did Zelda 2, and I did Link to the Past at one point. And the original plan for me was to continue onward, because I was going to do Ocarina of Time. I was going to do Majora's Mask and eventually Wind Waker. But time with everything, because I do so much content like every single week. You know, I'm playing different games all the time and things, you know, new developments happen, other games come out that I have to give attention to. It gets a little crazy. But one of the things that I will say about Link to the Past, you know, having played it in full, because I was first exposed to Link to the Past years ago when I was younger, like in the 90s or late 90s, I want to say, like before the Nintendo 64 came out, because I had a friend where we used to do this thing when we were younger where we got a console, you know, on our family and stuff, but we always had friends that owned other consoles. So sometimes, like, if I was the Genesis guy, which I was a Genesis kid growing up, I had a friend that had a Super Nintendo and eventually another friend that had a PlayStation at some point until I ended up getting my own PS2 down the line. And I would go to my friend's house every once in a while, and he would have a lot of the big classics for the Super Nintendo, including Super Mario World, which I still think is one of the best SNES games of all time, game of all time, Link to the Past, Donkey Kong Country. I believe he also had Final Fantasy II, if I'm not mistaken, or the Super Mario All-Stars like collection. At one point, he had a bunch of them like that. And that's how I got exposed to a lot of them, including Link to the Past. But I never fully appreciated it back then, because I feel like everybody at some point, whenever they're playing games, especially if you grew up with gaming and you have like, you know, that in the whole like upbringing with video games in your life, there are certain games that were probably big deals back then that you don't really understand that how big they were until later on in life, when you either get to play them or when you get to hear other people talk about them or expose you to elements of them, which I felt a lot of that about the Super Nintendo library. Because again, coming from the Sega side of things, there were other games I obviously didn't play during my youth. Again, like Super Metroid was another big one. Right. Chrono Trigger, I didn't play until much later on. I didn't even play the PlayStation port of that, you know, until much, much later on. I played I believe it was the DS port at one point where I really sat down and just played through that. But Link to the Past is one of those games I feel that doesn't get enough credit for how much of an influence it had on Ocarina of Time and other Zelda games that came afterwards. I feel like once you get to Link to the Past, that's the prototype or that's the archetype for the modern Zelda game, straight up. Because even in Ocarina of Time, the three gems, getting the Master Sword, you know, even elements of like the Dark Realm, you know, the duality of realms and places that you visit, Ganon, at least, you know, the way that stuff plays out, the cold open, or at least the opening where it's like, you know, you're running around with Zelda at the very beginning and stuff before things start to really get crazy. A lot of those elements and a lot of those things you could find in many other Zelda games that came afterwards. And it's a game that gets a lot of praise, but it really deserves a little bit more credit for a lot more of those nuanced things you don't appreciate till later in your life.
Yeah. I also don't think people really realize, looking back now, you know, when you're looking back at like the Super Nintendo library, I mean, it's really difficult, I think, to even begin to sort of compare games to it, because it's just so much more in depth. The story is so much more involved. I mean, outside of the big RPGs on the Super Nintendo, it's really difficult, I'd say, to find a game that has as much going on in it as A Link to the Past. There's just, you just sort of lack, like, well, A Link to the Past is more linear than the two games that had preceded it. Obviously, yeah, you know, the originals really open. I think it's still fine because the world is huge in its own right. I mean,
big time.
You have Hyrule, and then you get to go to the Dark World. There's secrets going back and forth. I mean, I can't even imagine what it would have been like to have played that one.
Oh, you need Nintendo Power straight up, like back then.
Yeah, I mean, there's just no way. I mean, it's just it's crazy. You know, it just replaying it was kind of bringing me back, you know, to I don't know how old you are. I'll be turning 35 and
you're my age. Yeah. Same generation.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's like, remember back in those days of like riding on the bus and you know, you're in school and everyone's like, oh dude, you gotta do this or you gotta do this. You know, this is before, you know, like even good dial up where you could get online and
This is all pre-internet mostly.
Right. And even if you did have the computer, and it, like, computers were crazy expensive.
Yes.
You know, until you hit around like 98 into like 2000. I mean, computers were expensive. And a lot of people had dial up until like 2007.
You know what other
people don't really realize that.
You know what people also did? Because I did this for years up to the point where my family got a computer, go to the public library and use the actual terminals there. That's where you actually had access to both the computer and also internet. That's how I played RuneScape for a long time.
That's
AOL to Instant Messenger. That's how I got exposed to all that. And then Sega Sages, which eventually turned into IGN, which, you know, that's how it all starts.
Yeah. Oh, I took computer classes in high school just so that I could like look up. And I was like, I wanted to be my first period because you get in and everyone's sitting on the computer. So I'd have like extra time at school to like go to like, it was, you know, like old, like this is, I mean, IGN was like a thing, but there was other websites like gamers.com. I think that just like disappeared and or turned into something, you know,
games.com, games radar.
Games radar used to be Cheat Code Central. It was it was like here's cheats and stuff like that. And you'd look them up, and there was all sorts of stuff that people wrote on there that weren't true at all.
Complete nonsense.
Right. The one in Final Fantasy where it's like you can get the Bronco, the little ship, right, and go fly it again, or you can get Aerith back. It's like, no, you can't. Like, you know, but it was the Wild West out there. But So A Link to the Past, right? I mean, obviously you sit and talk for hours about how great
that game is. Immaculate game.
Yeah, but I would say sort of my biggest takeaway just from sort of really diving into it and beating it for honestly like the first time is just, I don't know, maybe it's as I get older I find myself becoming maybe for nostalgic for games I didn't really grow up with. Like, you know, you just go back and sometimes you play this game and I just sort of think of like, man, this game would have been like perfect for me when I was a kid, and this is one of them. Because I think you just look at, you know, it's not like today where you can just get on Steam and you can go buy any game you want, right? Like, you only had certain games, you only had certain systems, you only had whatever growing up. And so I don't know, I just felt this sort of like wave of nostalgia even playing this game I never really played growing up. But absolutely, obviously, it's amazing. It deserves all of the credit.
That game is immaculate. It's a fantastic game. I still personally think it holds up even now. Like, people, like, if you want to show the better parts of the Zelda series, that's one of the games I feel like you give them in the top five to go play. You know, like, if you're going to get away from new releases coming out like currently and stuff, and you got to go into your backlog and stuff, that's one of the Zelda games I would tell people to play. Because it's so, to me, I still think it has its issues here and there. Like, I think there are certain sections and certain points where you definitely need a guide to know exactly what you need to do or where you need to go. But like, when you really kind of like get engrossed into it, it's an awesome, fantastic game. Definitely an iconic one of that console.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, all right. Hey, I'll toss it over to you. What, you know, what's one of the games you've been playing recently?
So I'm going to go more modern than the one that you suggested now. I'm actually going to talk about Jedi Fallen Order, because I actually went back to Jedi Fallen Order not too long ago. I played and beaten Jedi Fallen Order, the PS4 version, because I did a whole video review of it on my channel where I got into huge detail with that game. But getting ready for Jedi Survivor very soon, at the time of recording this, like a month or so away, give or take. And I went back to the PlayStation 5 version that went on PS Plus to go check out the, what is it, the challenges that you get from like the save points and stuff. And it just got me thinking a little bit more about that game and thinking about like modern Star Wars games going into the newer ones coming out, which is Jedi Survivor and whatever else we're going to get from like Ubisoft and afterwards. What makes Jedi Fallen Order so good to me and so such a standout is that it's one of the first, probably the only modern Star Wars game in the EA era that really stands on its own two legs, that doesn't have anything previously like holding it up, you know, to give it
like,
attention.
Like Battlefront or
like Battlefront, really Battlefront 2, Battlefront 1, etc. But also even Squadrons, I would argue, because Squadrons also has the legacy to live up to, but not only the X-Wing series, but also the Rogue Squadron series, which I think that a lot of people were comparing it to. But with Jedi Fallen Order, this was something different. It borrowed a lot of elements from the Soulsborne genre, from like Dark Souls, Bloodborne, etc. And you could even throw an Elden Ring in there. But with this one is that it took that concept, which is so notorious for being difficult for people, but really kind of like streamlined it and put it in the Star Wars universe and made it interesting. It made it just fun to be part of that. Because real talk, I don't like the Soulsborne genre. I really have a strong, not hatred, but a strong antagonistic attitude and vibe to that whole genre for many reasons. Like there's good aspects to them. But like at the time when I first played Jedi Fallen Order, I really wasn't feeling that genre at all. But this was the one that really kind of got me to like rethink my stance on it and really kind of like appreciate some of the better elements, you know, for what they were. And again, I like Cal Kestis as a character. I like his backstory. I like a lot of the reverence that that game had specifically for Star Wars lore and the timeline and the place in the timeline where it actually takes place. Because it's post Order 66, like a number of years after Order 66 and prior to the events of A New Hope and Kenobi and stuff. So it has a nice spot and also has a respect for the lore and the canon while also just giving us brand new stuff that fits nicely into everything. And I always thought that that was a really cool thing. That was probably, and again, in my opinion, the best EA Star Wars game that we ever got within this modern era of Star Wars games.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what's interesting is you actually just stole the one I was going to talk about, but that's okay. I can swap in something else. Because, yeah, I actually just started a replay of this Let's Play over my Star Wars channel. And, yeah, it's honestly, you know, I think when I first played it, I guess I don't know why I actually didn't like it as much as I am now, like replaying. I thought it was good. Of course, you get to Zepho or whatever the
planet Dathomir. Is. Dathomir. That's
Dathomir
the hard
is,
one.
Dathomir is okay, but Zepho is the one where you have just like terrible backtracking.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. True. It was just one of those things where it's like, God, the backtracking in this game is awful.
Yeah.
But outside of that, honestly, it's really good. And the ending is so amazing.
Yeah.
The story, once I got to it, I really appreciated it, but I just didn't end up diving back in and playing it. So now with Jedi Survivor coming out, I actually just started a Let's Play of it. And replaying it is so much fun, especially because I'm playing it on PC and I'm going back and adding like lightsaber mods and outfit mods and everything like that and replaying it. And honestly, sort of now that I know what to expect, you know, going in and replaying this game, it is actually a lot better than I think I sort of remembered. And maybe it's just because my, you know, rose-colored glasses causes me to remember like, oh, the story elements are awesome. But God, some of the middle is just like a little weak. But replaying it now, I'm like, no, actually, this is really, really good. Like the storytelling, the motion the writing's capture, great. Everything.
Writing's awesome.
Yeah. And now that we get to see, now that I've get to see a little bit of what Cal's story will be like going forward in Jedi Survivor, it's really interesting to go back and kind of look and be like, okay, what's actually going on here? What clues did they already potentially have looking at this? Because I think one of the interesting things I remembered from this game was, you know, one of the main plot points is they're searching for a Jedi holocron.
Yeah.
That contains the names of a lot of the people who survived Order 66. Well,
yeah, Force sensitive kids, basically.
Right. At that point, when that game came out, we didn't know, because I think it came out in 2019. So it came out before Rise of Skywalker and before The Mandalorian.
Yeah, it came out. So, yeah, that's right.
Actually, I think it came out right because I think 2019 was when it, I think it came out in just before, like a few months before Rise of Skywalker. And because Rise of Skywalker and
was December.
So this would have came out, before. So at that point, we weren't really like, okay, whatever. It's just Star Wars does this because they need to introduce new characters. And hey, guess what? It's another Jedi who survived Order 66, right? Mm-hmm. You know, okay, here we go.
He's going again. Back to it.
Here we go again. But I guess now we didn't realize, oh, hey, that in the Kenobi show, Obi-Wan's going to find this wall with like Quinlan Voss's name written on it and all these Jedi who may have survived Order 66 and how that could tie into something. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, now it's getting a little bigger. Now it's getting a little more interesting. I mean, obviously Jedi Fallen Order is so good that in the Kenobi show, they were like, hey, we're just going to rip off the entire plot.
Exactly. The whole section there in that show ripped straight from the game.
Oh my God. Like, so over my Star Wars channel, I was like going off about how I was like that episode of Kenobi. I was like,
it's second sister Reva.
I literally have videos where I'm like, it is frame for frame. Mm-hmm. The same thing, and it takes place at the same place like 5 years later in the story. Don't get me started. I like aspects of Kenobi, but I think overall the whole
I feel you.
overall the whole package, I have some I have some issues with.
I feel you.
But so regardless, I mean, the game is still really cool. You know, I think Malakos was a really cool sort of
fight.
Yeah. As idea for a villain, Vader might have been a little much at the end. I mean, it was awesome to see it, but it's kind of like, I don't know. Sometimes I think about, you know, like, do we need Vader? Does it sort of, I mean, it's great for the game. Game wise, it's great.
It was an awesome surprise for what it was at the end. It was an awesome surprise.
Yeah. Yeah. So for the bigger Star Wars universe though, I'm like, you know, should we save Vader a little bit? Right. You know, should he be this thing? I mean, when Vader's going one-on-one with like Kanan Jarrus a little bit there, and you know, and Rebels, it's like, okay, come on now. Vader's supposed to be awesome, but then at least in Kenobi we got to see him be like stupid powerful, which is great. But yeah, I mean, overall the game is great. I think I was also, when I first played it, was kind of in, for whatever reason, maybe comparing it a little bit to Force Unleashed, where I was like, you know, that's the kind of game where you really just
takes the Force really far. Right.
They're totally different.
Yeah, it was easily compared to it. But what I liked about this one is that, again, because it borrows elements from Soulsborne stuff, it makes a lot of the worlds around you, at least, you know, that part of the Star Wars universe, feel very intimidating. Because, like, you know, Cal goes up against a lot of these, like, giant creatures and stuff like that. And, like, you have a lightsaber. That doesn't mean that you're going to totally own these things. Like, they could still, like, brutalize you in that same way that you would see in a Soulsborne game.
Yeah. And I think that the sequel, just looking at the trailers we've already seen, I think Cal's going to be quite a bit more powerful in
this game.
Yeah, and I think it'll be like one of those things where it's like, maybe if this turns into a trilogy, which I think is maybe what they're going for. I kind of hope so.
I wouldn't be surprised.
It'll be kind of like when you go back and play Arkham. Like when I last year I did a replay of all the Arkham games, and it was kind of like when I went back to play Arkham Asylum for the first time. You know, it's like, because Asylum's the one I never go back to. I mean, it's obviously
City's, you know, where it's at though.
Yeah, but yeah, City is my favorite. And then Knight, and even Origins, you know, the combat just evolves so much more as the series progresses. So when you go back to Asylum, like, oh yeah, I can't just really like fly around. I can't do this. Not that the game is still like an absolutely amazing game. Yeah. But I think that'll be kind of the thing here too, where we'll remember the first game, like, oh, the first game had a really good story, but it'll be like this next game, which is where it's like, oh, the combat's more evolved, everything, and it'll be really, so Jedi Survivor is an amazing first step into whatever this is going to become.
Yeah, I can't wait to play it. Again, I got it on pre-order and stuff. Funny, the funny thing for me is that I have a perspective. I know someone who's working on it, that they're one of the people that have been doing some cool stuff, that they've kind of given us some insight in it. And it's giving me more excited, because I know there's even more time and effort that went into this sequel. That obviously, you know, with Jedi Fallen, even though a lot of time and effort went into both games and stuff, but like seeing what worked and what didn't work, what could have been approved from the first game, now going into this one, I think a lot of Star Wars fans are going to be very, very happy by the time we play this.
Yeah, I have no doubt that it's going to be an absolutely amazing, amazing game. Okay, well, I guess thankfully I did have a backup, so I still have two more things I can dive into here. Cool. So I guess, you know, November had a big game release, and I haven't had the chance to talk about it here on the podcast yet. And one of maybe your thoughts on this too, because I'm guessing you probably played it. Pokemon Scarlet and Violet.
I didn't play it, but I did get some insight into it because I skipped over this because there's other games that I was excited about, you know, for the end of the year that I wanted to play. But I have been looking at some stuff, like obviously the starters and everything that people have been sharing and such.
Yeah, so I have to say it is in some ways the most disappointing Pokemon game I've ever played.
I heard the frame rate was bad on it.
It's real bad.
Glitches, presentations all messed up.
Yeah, it's in some ways it's so disappointing, and in other ways it's like it improves some things so much that it's like I don't ever want that to change in Pokemon. So, you know, I mean, obviously the huge changes to it, it's sort of the first, I guess, open world Pokemon game, which in some ways is good.
Arceus, I thought would be Arceus would be the first open world, quote unquote.
Yeah, I guess mainline in the main core.
Yeah,
true. Right, in the main core. But here you kind of can go wherever you want, like from the get-go. Arceus, you still have like a kind of lengthy tutorial, and you're kind of this, it's like it's pretty open, which is really cool. In some ways I like it, and in some ways I don't. You know, I think it's more difficult to sort of compare, say, like Pokemon with being linear and say Zelda with linear, because Zelda is linear, but there's still a lot of secrets along the way. There's a lot of other things. Pokemon, I kind of feel like benefits a little bit more from being linear, in that some of the ways in which you progress in Pokemon, like really when you sit down and you sort of think about like the Pokemon mechanic, it's almost like each new area feels like a new step in the right direction. It feels like a new challenge, and it sort of gets progressive along the way. Here, not some things kind of scale and some things don't. So it's like kind of weird the way, you know, I think sort of the way they do it. And it felt like every new region you went to sort of mattered, where here it, because they open it up, it's kind of just like, okay, well, I'm actually just looking for the gym, like see you later, which isn't, you know, which sometimes is the case depending on how powerful you are, sometimes it isn't. So I think it's like just the idea of the open world in some ways works, some ways doesn't. It's maybe it's just new, and it's like haven't spent enough time with it. You need to see it fleshed out in a couple other games.
You know something, bringing that up, that kind of reminds me that the same type of effect that I guess you're starting to see more often now post Breath of the Wild, because Breath of the Wild was the exact same way for the Zelda series, where Zelda, like you mentioned, is a lot more linear for all extents and purposes, where you could deviate and do side quests, but like you're still going on a path like that. Right. And Pokemon, ever since Pokemon Red and Blue, whatever, has always been like that. Even Gold and Silver, which had more areas to go to, but it was still like you were on a guided path, even though you could do multiple things in there. I think what happens is that we're so kind of like programmed with a lot of these series to kind of be like that. Most games are linear by nature. So, and even with open world games like a Grand Theft Auto or something, you're still going to the mission areas. You have a general idea of like where to go, what regions to visit first, what areas you should be visiting first, as opposed to just going off and doing everything on your own. It's not like in Mega Man, where Mega Man, you could argue, is a little bit more non-linear compared to most other games, where you could do the Robot Masters in every single order that you want, even though there's a preferred order. You're not tied to that specific order. You could go to whatever place. With these games, because of how like certain things don't scale, I still feel like you lose that element for it, and it kind of makes it a little bit more difficult to kind of deal with stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think the other difference is, so to sort of compare it to, I'll take Xenoblade, for example. So I would say that the difference is in Pokemon, because everything is sort of type-based, you can go get a like level 20 electric, and now it's like, because you do run into regions and there are stronger Pokemon in certain regions of the game, of the area you're playing, but now there's no more random encounters, so everything is just open, so I can just skip it and, you know, go get this. And now, you know, it's not like back in the day where you had to wait to get Fly or you had to wait to get Surf. You can just kind of go, you know, do whatever, and you can unlock a point and fly there. So that's, I guess that's like the open worldness to it is just something that I don't know that it's necessarily good or bad. It's just different. So other things that they did change that's really cool is now they have, I guess, kind of in a way, like there's three main categories. Like it's no longer just only the gyms. Now you have these Titans, which are like big Pokemon you got to go fight. And then that sort of powers up this legendary that's running with you that you can use as like a motorcycle and like fly around and swim and all these different things. So like it's kind of cool that they did sort of start to include that, as well as the team. I don't even remember what they're called in this because they're not that important.
They're not like Team Rocket or Team Magma.
So it's like now whatever Team Rocket you're fighting against in this game, which I'm just blanking on unnecessarily. Now, so like those are like your three things, which in some ways is like, okay, I can make that my focus now, is like to go knock out that quest path if you want. And then this other one, which I think is actually kind of cool, because especially like the Titan thing that they added, because now it's like, okay, I'm going to go fight these like huge versions of it, which would be sort of equivalent to like the raid battles you fought in Sword and Shield.
Yeah.
But they're out in the open and you can see them. So like, that's a pretty cool addition. Just being able to do the battles with the Pokemon, like you just walk up and then they do it. Of course, I'm sure that caused frame rate issues, which is
probably
on the bad side for whatever reason, I guess. But the concept of that, I think, is cool, you know, going forward. I still think I'm okay with random encounters. I kind of feel like Sword and Shield to me was the perfect blend of everything, where you have here's a big area you can go to that's open. Here's this. And you can, you know, figure it out however you want. I mean, obviously then the bad thing is just the frame. The performance is
I heard that's a big, big problem with that game. They really got a bad blowback from many fans
It's the I guess my issue with the performance isn't even that, like, it'd be one thing, think about this for a second. The Witcher 3 runs on the Switch.
Yeah, funny enough, some black magic got that game to run.
Doom Eternal runs on the Switch.
Exactly.
Right? It'd be one thing if you were trying to load these like massive open areas, but honest to God, some of them are like deserts, which there's nothing in, and it's like a field of brown. It's like, how can you not load this? Like when I'm playing Xenoblade or Breath of the Wild or some of these other things, I think honestly, it was just more than Game Freak.
It just wasn't up to handle. Right.
I just feel like it's just not. Maybe it's because they did Arceus and Brilliant Diamond and Pearl and this, and it was like a lot for that team. Maybe it's a small team, right? I mean, you know, sort of, I guess, unfair to put all of those things on them. There's no like clothing options. Like you're just kind of stuck to like two or three, which in Sword and Shield there was tons of them. You know, there's a lot of things they change. You constantly it feels like the first 10 hours is a tutorial in this game.
Like it feels every
time you go do something new, it's like you have to sit through almost like a 10-minute like video, like not video but like a cutscene. You know, that you're just clicking through the text to get through. So I'd say it's a swing and a miss for this game. And honestly, if you haven't played it, I would avoid it.
That's what everybody keeps telling me. Cause like, I usually get to Pokemon games late. Like the last big Pokemon game, like mainline, I guess you could say, Pokemon game that I got into was Sun and Moon. Cause I got that for my 3DS and stuff. And I think that was fine for what it was. Again, it's a Pokemon game. Like, I feel like you don't have to dive into those games like day one. You don't always have to. If you're big into Pokemon, you're going to do so anyway. Like one of the big ones that I thought that was good, that was a spinoff game, was Pokken Tournament. Cause I just talked about that recently. And I got big into that ever since it first came out on the Wii U, and I've been playing it like here and there on and off and stuff. And I think sometimes now Pokemon has gone to the point where it's like, you know, they could start experimenting with a lot of different things off-site with its outside of its like mainline series and such, and see what other things could work to actually start getting things to go concurrently like that. But I even feel like maybe at some point, maybe Scarlet and such will get updated to the point where maybe things are a little bit stable, or they'll just completely drop it and move on to what's next. Because I feel like this one had such a big blowback, and it's so uncharacteristic of the Pokemon right. company when you really think about yeah. it, because it's not like they're always putting out garbage games, because even most of the Pokemon spinoffs aren't always that great. Like, I mean, we got Pokemon Stadium, we have Pokemon Tournament, Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, which are all great for all their stuff. Right. But then you get some of these other ones, like some people have never even heard of, like some random Pokemon spinoff on like the DS or something, or Conquest. That was one. I know some people like Conquest, but it's like,
you know which you one? Never what was the one they put out? Oh God, I played. Is it Pokemon Quest? It was on mobile too. They released it as like a free,
not Pokemon Go, but
I think it was Pokemon Quest. I have my Switch right here. I have my Switch right here. I will look it up. Man,
there's a cafe
game. There was the cafe game, but man, I went hardcore into that. I'll look it up here. But I think it was Pokemon Quest, and it was a mobile game, and it was free, and it was like a tap based game. Mm. It was just really, but I mean, I got like hardcore into that. But I will say, Pokemon Tournament was one that I really have always wanted to play. For whatever reason, I've never picked it up. But like, I'm a big 3D, I mean, Soul Calibur, Street Fighter, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's always one that's been on my list. So I still may pick it up at some point.
You know what's crazy about that? And they kind of dropped the ball. At least it was Bandai Namco that really dropped the ball. They could have kept going with DLC with that, or did another iteration of that, because the concept of it is cool. The biggest problem with that game is the balance, straight up. Like, because I played it a lot, and I used to play a lot with Machamp and stuff, and it always felt like certain characters just didn't have an answer to a lot of other tools that other characters had, which is very important for fighting games. Like, you always want to have balance, especially for the competitive scene like that, because there was like a competitive scene for Pokken Tournament for a time, and then it just dropped, you know, because at some point, like, there's not much else that could be done if the company's not going to do anything else with it. But I really do hope they one day revisit that actual concept, because I thought it was cool. Again, when we got the DLC for DX, for the DX version, we had Blastoise in there, which was like really out there. Right. Like, there was all these other things that they could have done.
Yeah. I got into Pokemon Unite for a little bit I will say I like MOBAs. I got really into like Heroes of the Storm. I never played League, none of these other things. So when it came out, I was like, oh, it's on the Switch, I can play it. I played it pretty like solid for about like 2 weeks, you know, like, and then I put it down, put it back up, and then just moved on to the other thing. There's just too many games. You just can't keep up.
I really believe it. I think also the Pokemon crowd are the ones that are diehard Pokemon that usually get Pokemon everything and stuff. They're just certain genres that I just don't think they resonate with. They resonate with RPGs because that's what Pokemon is. It's like the first like true streamlined JRPG for most people that isn't Final Fantasy. But like, when you start branching off to things like outside of that, or outside of like, you know, Pokemon Snap, or outside of Pokemon the trading card game stuff, you start getting into these other genres which might work for it, but like that core crowd that's like always stuck with it, or the real core like audience for that series, I just don't think they're going to care about a lot of that stuff. A lot of them, if they're playing a game like that, a MOBA, they're already playing League. Why go to Pokemon Unite at that point?
Right. Yeah, I think it's hard sometimes to try and say, hey, we're going to take this genre and we're just going to license it with our intellectual property and, you know, see if it works. Mm-hmm. I think there's some things where it does. I mean, even, you know, you could say Blizzard did that, where they're like, hey, we're going to make Heroes of the Storm with our characters. It's like, is the Blizzard cast of characters really that strong on its own?
Not really. They got good franchises. Really. They got great franchises. Diablo. Diablo's that series, but still, like, it's not like iconic, where it's like you could get like a Smash Brothers S type of thing going for them.
Right. I mean, even PlayStation tried it. Yeah. I do think if PlayStation tried it again, I feel like they could pull it off.
Their problem was at the very start of it, number one, they tried so hard to be not like Smash Brothers, and everybody wanted them to be like Smash Brothers. And number two, they dropped the studio that they built to actually make that game. They just completely disbanded them. And it's like, you know, games like that, or again, fighting game franchises and competitive scenes need time to grow. And like, you need content to support it. And PlayStation has franchises they could have pulled from to make that game still keep going, and they just chose not to.
Yeah, I know. Did you ever play, it was on, I think it was on PS2. I know it was on Wii, because I have it for Wii. But there was a Ninja Turtle Smash Brothers game.
Yeah, I forgot the name of it, that it was called, but I did play
I think it's called TMT Smash Up.
It's similar to the Nickelodeon All-Star Brawl game.
Right. Yeah. But it was good. I remember playing it. The difference, though, was that you, of course, now they've added this to Smash Brothers since, but they had a like a health bar, which you could knock people out of. But it was actually, I mean, it kind of worked. And I've always thought that the Smash Brothers style of game could work so well. And, you know, I mean, hey, somebody has actually pulled it off, and that's DC. Well, not DC, Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
With multiverses.
Exactly.
So I think that it works. You just, you know, you need a good core of like characters. Like I've always thought that Star Wars should do it. Like if you did
Star Wars needs to stay away from the fighting genre, period. They had a massive L. I reviewed that game for Masters of Terras Kasi.
Stay
far away from the genre.
Yeah.
I should say that because there is a fan-made mod/game that was made that was a Force Combat.
Force Combat.
Yeah. That's pretty much like Mortal Kombat that does that way for a 2D fighting game. So it can work. You just need the right mind and the right team to put it together.
Well, I just made some shorts over my Star Wars channel about I just recently installed it through a PS3 emulation of Soul Calibur 4, where you can play Starkiller and Vader and Yoda's in the 360 version.
Yep.
But I mean, that worked there. I mean, I do think the Smash Brothers style,
the formula,
of course. I think really Disney missed the bag by letting Warner Brothers
they could have binged that.
Because I mean, because you could have had Darth Vader versus Iron Man. And
in their defense, Disney did do Disney Infinity, which is the platformer version of it, and they also did kart racers too, because there's a lot of Mickey/Disney kart racers that are exactly like that, like Mario Kart.
Right. Yeah. It's just a shame that we just don't have more Star Wars. Like when I think about that, I'm like, man, Star Wars would work. Just Star Wars alone would work for a Smash Brothers style thing. But hey, Warner Brothers is doing it with multiverse. Have you played multiverses?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Hands down. Yeah. I played that same opening week when it first came out and stuff. And it was fun. It was cool. It's just, again, you got with games like that, you got to stick with it. And especially if you don't get the free version with it, you got to stick with it to be within that community. And again, a lot of those genres of games, they constantly fall victim to the comparison to Smash Brothers because they just did it so well with that series. Like that's like the easiest comparison for most.
Because nobody nobody ever tried it for a long time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's the difference is like, you know, I mean, it's like nobody said no, at this point we did back in the day call everything a Doom clone, you know, it's like, oh, you're everything was a
Hexman is a Doom clone. That's literally fantasy.
Yeah. but now they're all just first person shooters because the genre has expanded. But I mean, really you have to think about it. I mean, Smash Brothers came out in probably 98, 99, something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so then the next game that I can even think of that was somewhat close was that Ninja Turtles game that would have been like 2008, but that's like Ninja Turtles only. Then the next, I'd say, big one would have been PlayStation, which would have been 2009 at the earliest, probably 11 or something. Probably 11 or 12 as you're, it was sort of towards the middle to end to PlayStation library. So I mean, at this point Smash Brothers is still going, so multiverses is the first one. Really, that's even sort of
like
I mean, there's been others, right? I mean, there's Brawlhalla and some other things, but I think
Indie Pogo is another one that pretty much takes that same concept but puts everybody in. It's indie characters from like various indie games, but makes them do pogo sticks, like jumping.
Yep. That's right. So it's just interesting, man. I think Star Wars alone would work. Of course, I mean, you just do it with Disney because I mean. Disney Smash Brothers game would be awesome.
Exactly.
I mean, Buzz Lightyear and Darth Vader.
Marvel.
And all the Marvel characters.
Lucasfilm, because you could throw Indiana Jones and Willow in there too. Like, there's so many things. Ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. Be absolutely so insane. Awesome. Awesome. Okay. I don't know whose turn. I think it's your turn.
So my number two. So technically I'm going to use one that I actually did a review for today that I actually published today was the Lord of the Rings games. And I look at them as one pair, which is both Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers and Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, the two hack and slash games by EA. Now there was other games based on Lord of the Rings made by various companies, including a Fellowship of the Ring game, but that was all done by different people. It's not the EA games. Funny enough, I even said in the review, Two Towers, originally before that came out, they were going to do a Fellowship of the Ring game that was exactly like that. But because they couldn't get it out in time for the movie stuff, they just put all that stuff that they were going to do for that, put it in the Two Towers. And now you have that game as what we know. The problem is, at least I find, is that I don't think these games hold up. These games are looked at like with a lot of rosy tinted glasses, you know, a lot of nostalgia. And I understand it because when those movies were coming out, those were the same type of vibes that people had for Star Wars when the prequels were out. Because you played the Phantom Menace game, you played the Clone Wars games or Attack of the Clones, you played the Revenge of the Sith game that everybody played because it was right before the movie. Same exact thing. The difference is, though, is that I find, at least with the Lord of the Rings games, there's a lot of, like, not revisionist history, but a lot of things that are just given a pass, technically wise, with those games. Having gone through both now, and, like, again, I love Lord of the Rings. I love that series. I think that the movies are awesome. Not so much The Hobbit, but, like, the three Peter Jackson movies. But technically, those games, those were from an era where you could get away with stuff like this for a licensed game, no matter what platform it was. Because remember, these games were on PlayStation 2. They were on the GameCube. I don't think they were on the Xbox, the original Xbox. I'm not sure. Like that Two Towers and Return of the King. I know they were on GameCube. People played the GameCube version a lot and the PS2.
Yeah, I have it. I have them. I have both for the game. I have both for the GameCube. I think Return of the King. I think Return of the King might have been an Xbox. I'll take a look.
Because I don't remember Two Towers being on there.
Two Towers, I'm pretty sure, was not.
But the thing was, is that I feel like technically wise, like these games, like there's a lot of problems with them. There's a lot of collision and hit detection issues. There's a lot of difficulty spikes. There are things that fundamentally by design just are so frustrating, especially towards the later portions of the game. The second to last mission, the penultimate mission of Two Towers, like that is notorious for being like almost unfairly difficult. For the stuff, because you have to face 14 waves of orcs that are coming at you while defending this one section, and some of them explode, and like you're getting hit off camera.
It's brutal.
It's brutal. And like Return of the King is the same thing. The other problem I had with Return of the King, and you find it in Two Towers as well, where you get locked in these situations where you're constantly getting hit by enemies and there's no way for you to get out of them. Like you're unresponsive. Like your controls just don't do anything. Your character's locked in areas with the camera placement being weird and like little things that you just can't see that you're kind of just getting boxed in by enemies and like, you know, obstacles and stuff. Little things like that would not be forgiven in this day and age. Like that. I would even argue in that same era with some of those games that were being done within that same genre, we had other games that didn't have as many problems as though that just did things better. There were still also action games or hack and slash games. And it's like, I think it just really, these two games just got along on their names alone, just seriously as like an IP, because they're Lord of the Rings and it was what it was back then.
Yeah. And you know, I did look it up. I guess actually they both, I was with you. I did not think Two Towers came out on Xbox. It says on Wikipedia, it says it did. Return of the King did, but yeah, I had them both on GameCube.
Yeah. I've only seen them on GameCube and PS2.
That's right. Physically. Yeah. But whatever. I agree. I think, you know, it's just, you go back and, you know, again, another thing where it's like back in those days, there weren't a lot of, at that point, there were actually beginning. We had finally gotten to the point to where there were decent, licensed games. And at that point, I think we'd also shifted from the idea of, oh, this is a licensed game to like, because, you know, at that point, like there's SpongeBob games and, you know, there's like
movie-based game was a thing. That was a
whole movie-based games were like another category to sort of move into. And yeah, there weren't really a lot of good ones at that point, but we'd finally gotten to the point where they were decent. Like you go back to like the PlayStation 1 and 64 era, other than like GoldenEye, a lot of them were trash.
A lot of trash. I mean, you could argue though, in the 16-bit era, I would say, like, you did have licensed games that were based on films or TV shows that were pretty good. I mean, a lot of people point to stuff like, again, the Super Star Wars series, for obvious reasons, even though, again, that's very debated, because having replayed some of those games now, like how unfairly, ridiculously difficult they could be. We had very different guidelines back then. Let me put it this way, for quality.
But even those, to be fair, also, so those, like, okay, but Star Wars had existed for like, you know, that's like the early 90s. Right. So it's different when, oh, hey, a movie's coming out and they have to rush a game out, which was often the case. Mm-hmm. So for these to come out and even be like decent for the time, I think causes people, one, I'm with you, to look at these with a little more rose-colored, you know, glasses. And two, there's not in general a lot, when you compare Lord of the Rings, when you think about how big and massive Lord of the Rings is, when you compare it to, say, Star Wars or Batman or some of these other movie franchises, which in reality it's just as big as, there's not really that many Lord of the Rings games. Like in general.
A lot of them are not really known. Like those are the two that everybody remembers. But like the Fellowship of the Ring game was like an action adventure, like RPG. And even there was other ones. Like, you know what was a good one?
There's a Hobbit game.
It's a Hobbit game. Here's the one that a lot of people don't give a lot of credit to: The Third Age, which played like Star Wars Battlefront. That was literally Star Wars Battlefront. Like, and it's like nobody really.
Yeah, I mean, not it. Yeah. It's not really until like the Shadow of Mordor games, which are great. Yeah. I mean, those are great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But say you go back, I mean, you look at games that came out, because, you know, a lot of games where they came out with the movie, and this game, both of these games had it, the big deal was, oh, hey, we're going to show, like, clips of the movie.
Exactly.
In
Revenge of the Fifth had the same thing. It was literally right before the movie came out.
Yeah. Like, it's sort of the selling point for it. But, yeah, I'm with you. I think they're sort of, because I played Two Towers, and I know the exact spot you're talking about.
Yeah, everybody knows it's the 20th. Yeah. Like,
it's so bad. Man. I played it a couple years ago when I was a lot more hardcore into collecting and like, you know, trying to build a collection. Is that I bought that. I remember everyone saying, "Oh, this game's great." But yeah, I think it is. By today's standards, it's definitely rough around the edges. At the time, I think it's one of those things where it's like, at the time, it was probably like a 7 out of 10. And by today's standards, it's like,
you go back and read some of those older reviews. Cause I just looked on like Metacritic just to get the links to go to see some. And like some of the things that they were saying in some of those reviews, like, y'all really probably didn't play this game. Cause some of the stuff that I'm seeing that's like, I got a problem with this are like in the first couple stages. Like, there, I can't begin to tell you when I was making that video review on those two games, like how many times I wanted to chuck my controller in certain sections. Yeah. Like, just dealing with things that I knew wasn't my fault because of like just how it was designed and stuff. And it's just like, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, you have to kind of put yourself, like, you had to check yourself at the door. It's like, okay, this was done and made at a different time where we don't have the same level of quality of like certain games that if it was made now, we probably wouldn't see some of these things like that. And also the difference in technology. I feel like obviously the PlayStation 2 or the GameCube was very different than what we got from the PS5 or the Xbox Series X. You couldn't do back then. That's why sometimes it's a little hard for some people to review retro games, or at least when you see people that review retro games, you can usually tell like who's been doing like, you know, critique on retro video games for longer than who else. But it's like one of those things where it's like, okay, you check that at the door and you understand like, okay, this was on this console that was capable of this thing. Like, there's a certain leeway you could give it. But then there's that one point where it's like, you know what, like, they, like, enough's enough. Like this is just bad by design. It's just frustrating and annoying.
Yeah, no, yeah, I'm like 100% in agreement with you on this. That, yeah, you can tell. I mean, by today's standards, these games, they're, you know, definitely a little rough around the edges. But I'm even trying to think of like other games, in all honesty, that were, I mean, obviously Revenge of the Sith is really good, but sort of in that era.
Batman Begins.
That one's actually incredibly underrated game. I think
it's just for itself.
Because when people think about Batman games, they just think, well, the Arkham games, right? But man, Batman Begins, if you go back and play that game, and same thing, had footage of the movie. I think it came out maybe just a little before, but it's another one that's actually like surprisingly good.
Spider-Man 1 and 2 specifically.
Spider-Man 1 is Spider-Man 1. I actually played a lot more of it. I think that's another Spider-Man game that's underrated, because 2 came out and 2 is like,
the greatest of all time.
It's like getting the new one is like the best Spider-Man games ever.
The funny thing is, it's like the ones that people usually go to say that are like really good, like, you know, movie-based or license-based games like that, like, you can understand why people say that for some of them, you know, at least a good chunk of like Spider-Man 2, like Revenge of the Sith, or any of the ones that we mentioned. Stuff. But then there's others that I feel like are also like good in their own right that are just get completely overlooked or forgotten, like the Batman the Animated Series game that's on Genesis. Mm-hmm. And so not the Super Nintendo one, because the Super Nintendo and the Genesis ones, they're very different. And that was a thing with that time frame, because there was usually licensed games on both platforms, but they were very different. Like Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, those are two very different. Very like different the one games. At Genesis plays like Street
Batman
Fighter.
Batman Returns
totally. Is another. I love the Genesis Batman Returns. I think that game is highly underrated, and the soundtrack specifically is
that's really
underrated.
Good.
But the Super
Nintendo, the Sega CD version of that game is like that's like the Nintendo one is they're totally different. The Super Nintendo one is amazing too.
There's a lot of games that are like that I feel like when you really go down the rabbit hole of like what a license-based games is, you could find more gems than turds, more than likely. Even you could even go further back all the way to like Atari 2600 again with Star Wars again with going all the way to like, you know, DOS games and stuff like, again, you can find a lot out there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Agreed. Mm-hmm. Okay. Is it my turn?
I think
it's my turn. All right. So my number three, my last game. So this is actually another sort of, this game came out, I think, I don't know when that, I'll look up when this version of it came out, but it's going to be the Tony Hawk Pro Skater 1 and 2.
The remake?
The remake. So I bought it when it first came out on PC. Absolutely loved it. And then I knew that it came out on Switch, but I remember I looked over because I'd always see it on sale and stuff like that. And I was kind of like, never picked it up. And it just finally was on sale. And I was like, all right, screw it. I'm going to buy it. I'm going to pick it up. And the Switch version, I'm actually shocked at how well the Switch version plays. Now, obviously, you cannot compare the Switch version
to the PlayStation,
PlayStation PC version, right? I mean, that's not even, you can't even begin. I mean, the Switch version is a lot more muddy, whatever. But it's great, actually. The Switch version, it's definitely a step down, but it's still a huge step up from the original PlayStation, N64 versions, and it's so much fun to dive back into it. And now, you know, a lot of times I'm actually fine picking up a game on Switch knowing that there's going to be a performance hit or whatever. Sometimes I look to see if it's like, is it still 60 frames, is it 30 frames, you know, is that like, is that big difference going to be a thing for me? Because I actually play Switch, I'd say 90% handheld.
Yeah, that's what most people are.
Yeah, I think it's just like, just because like if I'm in my office, then I'm gonna be playing my PC. I'm gaming on my PC because that's why I'm here. Unless I'm like recording something or, you know, doing something else. And then I've picked up a few like little handheld emulators, like the Retroid Pocket, if you're familiar, with any of those. So it's like, okay, so then if I'm playing some other games, I'm not emulating on my computer as often because I'm playing, you know, on that. So my Switch is like 90%. Handheld. And then I've gotten really into finding alternative options to Joy-Cons because I
hate Joy-Cons. You gotta get that Pro controller.
And I think they suck. Well, I love the Pro controller, but I actually picked up the Retro Flag.
Oh yeah, I've seen these before. A lot of people say they're really dope.
It's amazing. If you don't have it, it is, I would say if you play in handheld, because you actually can't dock it. Even I have like a third party dock where you can just plug right in. I have a few other Joy-Cons that are like, I forget the name of the company, but they have like actual sort of grips in the back. You know, there's a bunch of those things, but this thing is freaking sweet because one, unlike Joy-Cons, even like good quality non-Nintendo Joy-Cons, I still always feel like even with, unless you're using like a grip, which I do also have, I have like the Satisfy grip, my wife's Switch. She got really into Splatoon too. And then my Switch became her Switch. So I had to buy it. So I bought the OLED. So it ended up working out. But you know, the Switch has, I still feel like they sort of bend sometimes a little bit, or, you know,
you feel that.
Right. So these things, and I'm sure there's other ones too, but this one is like the GameCube one and it's amazing. One, it has like really sick triggers, has like the GameCube style joy thing and like a C-stick right here as well, but it locks in. So it locks in. So I'm just like, I don't know what it is, but it's totally just like changed. It's like the Switch has turned into like a completely like more.
You can play Smash Ultimate on that thing and feel good.
Absolutely. Yeah. It feels infinitely more pro, you know, not that I want to say it's the Switch Pro, but I mean, it's the OLED and it's the whatever. So
yeah.
But, and the OLED, I think switching from the old one to the OLED has now caused me to like look at games. I'm like, it's because I will say the difference in the screen is enormous. Yeah,
that's what some people say.
It's way bigger than I thought it would be. One, because it's the full screen, but the screen is seriously so much better that it's a incredibly noticeable difference. So even some games end up looking better. So with all of that said, now I'm playing Tony Hawk Pro Skater on the Switch, and I even know it's like I could play this on PC and it'd look better, but it's just such a great experience. Yeah, it's such a great experience. And I mean, Tony Hawk is so great. I think actually it's perfect for the Switch because your levels are like 2 minutes or whatever.
Yeah,
and so now it's like, yeah, I can pop in, you know, go play a couple levels while you're on the Switch, which I mostly do. Like, we're on the couch at night once we've done work and we're just hanging out, you know, whatever. But then we have a dog, so it's like, okay, gotta get up. And you know, I have a puppy, so it's like, all right, gotta do this, gotta do that. So it's perfect. So Tony Hawk is like perfect for me to just, okay, sit down and play a little bit. And obviously it's an amazing remake of some of the best games ever. I mean, Tony Hawk 2 is still the second highest rated game on Metacritic ever. It's like, really? Ocarina of Time. Ocarina of Time, wow. Tony Hawk Pro Skater 2 is the top two video games on Metacritic.
That is super like random and surprising. Like, I can understand, because the one thing I will say about the two Tony Hawk games, especially about the remake, the originals, those were a vibe. Like, I don't think that people, unless you were gaming a lot in that era, you're not going to understand like just how big Tony Hawk was back then. The first, not even just the first two games, the first three, I would even argue like the first four games
of that I think the first five, because for me, I feel like they progressively got better all the way to Underground. I feel like Underground 2 was a little bit of a drop. American Wasteland was kind of cool, and then it just kind of fell off after there.
Yeah. Once you got to me, board.
Right. To me, Underground is the pinnacle of Tony Hawk. I think Underground is the best. But yeah, 2, 3, and 4 were all like 2 and 3
they were vibes back then, like, because it was the soundtrack. The soundtrack helps make those games. Like, the gameplay is fun, it's easy to get into skateboarding, far better than skate, in my personal opinion. I think that skateboarding as a sport works better in the game realm as an arcade style game, where it's like it's not complicated to do tricks. You're focusing more on just style as opposed to like actual technique, and I think that to me like worked out for those games. But really, the soundtrack of Tony Hawk 1, like just Superman, just the whole thing, that whole, again,
the second one had Rage Against the Machine.
Machines, like the music of that game, it was part of the whole culture of skateboarding and like that alt, like, you know, late 90s and early 2000s culture. It was really a vibe.
The X Games was huge. I mean, it was the right place, right time. And the different, like, going from 1 to 2 was also like, one, again, just what we talked about earlier with like Arkham and some of these other things. It's like, man, 1 was just such a huge game. And when people say like there was nothing else like it, I mean, there was literally nothing else like it. I mean,
you had stayed on the NES. There you go.
Game, not even like, it was just, it came out, it was just like this, it was a completely new genre, really. I mean, extreme sports games existed, but nothing like this.
There's only one game I could think of that was close to it, and it was garbage compared to Tony Hawk, and that was like the Dave Mira.
I think Dave Mira came out after.
Yeah, it came out afterwards. That's what I'm saying. Like that was the only other one I could think of that was like.
There's another skateboarding game. It's like Thrasher Skate and Destroy.
Oh yeah, Skate and Destroy. Yeah, but that wasn't like.
Nowhere close. So, but then you go from Tony Hawk 1, which is amazing. Great levels, everything. You know, Area 51 at the end, you unlock it. It was like the right level of like over ridiculousness. The top. Ridiculousness, but with like arcadey, so anybody could pick it up, and there's still like really cool when you're playing as all these cool, you know, skaters,
real
and everything.
Skateboarders too, real
secrets,
borders.
Like there were secrets and all this stuff. Then you get to the second game, and the second game lets you not only create a character but create a park. Like that was insane. Mm-hmm. Like now I can go make whatever I want, and you can unlock Spider-Man, and it was like,
yeah, I was gonna say like the licensed sweet characters, like, that you get in there, and then it got even more ridiculous in the next one. In part B, you play as Darth Maul.
Yep. It's like then, really crazy. Darth Maul and Wolverine, I think.
And Wolverine, yeah.
Three. Right. And then 4 was Jango Fett and somebody else. Iron Man.
It's like crazy. It gets ridiculous. Yeah. Like that whole series, so much fun.
It gets ridiculous. But having said that, they actually did kind of remake 1 and 2 on the PlayStation 3. I think maybe it was on 3.6. It's called Tony Hawk HD, and it was kind of a remake, but it didn't do as well, and it didn't have like the same soundtrack. And it was just like some of the levels from 1, some of the levels from 2, but that was kind of it. But this one's like it's not even close. So this has all the original soundtrack of both 1 and 2, plus some more like modern stuff. And honestly, the soundtrack choices like fit so perfectly. Like, you know, you're still listening like Superman and Rage Against the Machine and all that stuff. And then it's got like Machine Gun Kelly, you know,
it fits the culture.
It just flows so freaking perfectly. You can create a skater, all the stuff. The only criticism I have of this game is that Spider-Man isn't in it. I mean, that's it. But obviously, keep in mind,
you know why we got that? Because remember, Activision at the time of those two original
developed
games,
the Spider-Man games.
Had the license games for Spider-Man. Exactly. Like, and it made sense because that's cross promotion between brands and stuff. But like, again, even without something like that, which was a product of the time like that, these games are still fantastic. Like, if you knew, if you were part of that era, like playing them, you love this game. If you never got exposed to it, then you still got a bunch of dope stuff to really kind of, you know, get an insight into what it was like back then.
Yeah. Yeah. They, I guess I've read that there were initially plans to do the same thing with 3 and 4, but at some point they were scrapped. I think because like Activision is in the process of being acquired by Microsoft. And so they're like, okay, we got to like wait and, you know, review some of that stuff. So we may see it someday. I would say what they should do is they should remake 3 and 4, and they should just do like even an HD re-release of
Underground 1 and 2.
Of course, one of the biggest issues with this is licensing music.
Yeah,
just because
exactly. That's got to be the biggest hurdle. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I think everything else is probably is all honestly. And I've seen interviews with Tony Hawk where he's all like, yeah, I'm all for it. Keep it rolling.
I mean, if they
especially
sell.
Because especially because Tony Hawk Pro Skater 5 was trash.
Yeah. So that's the reason why we got these in the first place, to be honest with you, because Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 5 was so bad on release. Like, it was so like bugged up and just banged up like in the worst way possible. That game was like irredeemable. Like, it was just so terrible.
Right. It looked like a game that, in all honesty, and I think it was, that was like 30% complete.
Not even like it was really bad.
It literally, like, if you just go look up videos of it, it literally looks like you're in a
dev kit. I remember the review.
I mean, seriously, like it looks so like you're in a dev kit. Like, there's no other way to describe. Like,
it's terrible. Terrible. Ugh.
So bad. Awesome. Okay. What's your last game, bro?
So my last game, I had to kind of think about this a little bit because like, what would be like a really good one that would make sense to end on it, but I'll go back to retro, and it's actually one that came out just today. We could talk about, today specifically, GoldenEye 007, the re-release both on Xbox Series X and S and also Nintendo Switch, because I mean, people love 007, people love and have a reverence for GoldenEye, you know, from the N64. That game helped make the FPS genre on that console. I don't think it helped really contribute a ton to the genre as a whole when you really look at the scope of like the genre over the years over different platforms, but it really did do a lot for people that wanted to get into different types of genres for games, you know, for multiplayer gaming, split screen multiplayer gaming, you know, in that era. I thought it was pretty good. It also, to me, now replaying parts of it now, because I played a little bit earlier today, I did some video stuff with it for TikTok, and like, there are just certain things that like we take for granted now this day and age in FPS genre games, but like, it's still like, you know, it's a time capsule from back then, because this was like, you know, movie license games. It was a real big pioneer for most people for that genre on that console. It had a whole vibe to it. And again, the pause music, everybody makes a big deal about, which is so good. Like, that there's a lot of good, fun things to it. So seeing it get re-released in some fashion at a time, a lot of people didn't think was possible because of the licensing stuff. But it's still cool to see it. I will say, though, biggest criticism, which they have to change this at some point, they need to put the online multiplayer on Xbox, on the Xbox version of it. Because for the Switch, apparently from people that I know that have bought it and played it on there, it's garbage because there's hardly any matches they could get into. And it's like, this game feels like it was made for Xbox Live. Like, it'd be like at home to play people online split screen with that. But, you know, I digress.
I dove into it for a second today, but it feels no different than when I've emulated it. But I will say, I did get this. They actually sent this to me, Retro Fighters.
I have that same controller. Well, I have the gray one of that.
Yeah. There's the gray one. This is the one that connects to your Switch. I did a short in TikTok about this. And man, oh my God, this thing. And I'm not just saying it because they sent it to me. It's like, I would never, I'll never play N64 without it, because when you're emulating N64, I hate using an analog stick for it. I hate using an analog stick to emulate the C buttons because it just doesn't work as well. Especially when you're playing Ocarina of Time, I'm like, hold on a second. Like, which way do I want
to go? Like this instead of just pressing the buttons is weird.
So having the actual C buttons is so much better. And then of course this analog stick here is infinitely better
than the N64
than the N64 one. So I like, for me, like my go-to N64 game, which I play all the time, and I play it on Switch because he doesn't really use C sticks all that much, is Wave Race 64. To me, is still like,
okay, cool.
It's in my top three like favorite games ever. I play it all the time, just I don't know why, just addicted to it. But it's like having this like analog stick, which I know that game actually emulates well. But other games, man, you need like the C stick. If you go back and try to play some of the, WWE games, right?
Oh, or, yeah.
NWO Revenge. You got to use the buttons. And some games, it's just better to have those buttons.
They were designed for that controller. They were just made for that controller. Right.
Yeah, for me, that's the case. Now, actually, oddly, GoldenEye actually had back then, people do it like speedrunners use it. You can actually use two N64 controllers. And there's crazy controller options for it. And this existed on the N64. You can use two N64 controllers. Hold on.
Oh man, that's news to me, because I mean, I whenever I play these games, I've always just defaulted to the controls that they had on there. I really didn't mess around with the
controls. I have two right here. Can use two N64 controllers and play like this, like with like two different things. It's wild, but speedrunners use it because it's better for certain levels and stuff like that. Because the biggest problem with GoldenEye is that you walk.
You have to turn
thing, and you have to turn, but you're sort of using the C buttons to kind of either really strafe. So you really just have sort of walk and strafe. Now you have to hit the right bumper, which on the N64 controller, there's only one, and that will bring up like aiming. Exactly. So it's definitely a little archaic by today's but people don't understand just how insanely good. Cause again, we say nothing like it. I mean, to go from Doom, which honestly controlled better, to this was like, it's like when Tony Hawk came out.
The big contributing factor to it, one was the James Bond license, which I think was a huge, huge factor for it.
Because the most
underrated
soundtrack ever.
Yeah, that. But also keep in mind, I think what made this game really stand out is that especially the single player levels, besides the multiplayer, which was huge in its own right, the single player levels were pretty big, and like they were recreating scenes from the GoldenEye movie, which I think the way it was done back then, you know, for the technology at the time was really impressive to a lot of people. I mean, jumping off the dam the first time you do it in that first stage like that, like again, it's like you're actually doing it as James Bond. So it really stood out to a lot of people for that.
Yeah, I think also, you know, with the multiplayer, something people... So I think people forget, and today I think we take it for granted because you can just hop into like Call of Duty and Warzone and play it with like 100 people or whatever. But there was a big difference of like I had a PlayStation and then I got a 64 later in its life cycle, and then I had a Dreamcast which had it, and the GameCube and like the Xbox. But man, the difference of like PlayStation only had two controller ports. Yeah, multi-taps weren't like incredibly easy to get because and they were expensive, and you're a kid, you don't have a lot of money, man. If I have an N64, I can just go over to my buddy's house, and everyone's like, bring your controller.
Yeah. Bring your own controller,
bring your controller. But on the N64, you can have four people just plug in. Like that ease of access, that friction.
And there were so many games that did that. Again, you had GoldenEye, Smash, you had Brothers, Smash Mario Brothers, Kart. You had Mario Kart, Mario Party, you had wrestling games.
Pokemon Wave Stadium, Race, all Mario, of it.
So many different things that could work for that. And again, a lot of for that console anyway, was built around the idea of just getting together and doing multiple like games like that with other people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's insane. GoldenEye is so good. Now, I don't know if it was old or not, but it showed up in my feed. I saw you talking about Perfect Dark the other day.
Yes.
And, that's something people don't really realize because there was, so, you know, there was
Rare made the game.
Right. There was four Pierce Brosnan Bond movies. I don't think Die Another Day got video games, but
around that time frame, he actually had different games with him, that which was Agent Under Fire and Nightfire. Which Agent Under Fire technically is not even really a Pierce Brosnan one. It's really Nightfire was the game of that era.
But they're both those are actually like pretty solid. Yeah, they're pretty solid. But so there was Tomorrow Never Dies, which is on PlayStation exclusive, and it's like third person, whatever. It's okay
in comparison.
Right, and then there's World Is Not Enough, which is like kind of okay, actually like EA developed it. Yeah, mm-hmm. And then they're the PlayStation version is slightly different than the N64 one. So, but really, like the real sequel to
GoldenEye
is Perfect Dark, because Rare made it, and it's like it just expands so much into it too. And I always go back and forth about which game is actually better, because it's one of those things where it's kind of like really, Perfect Dark is the better game. I mean, if you really step back and you look at it, Perfect Dark is the better game because the combat is so much more evolved. You get the railgun, you get like the laptop gun, which you can show up. It, like, Perfect Dark is honestly insane to really think about. Like, one, it actually runs a little bit smoother than GoldenEye.
Got the expansion pack.
With the expansion pack. Like, it's kind of crazy to think that Perfect Dark is actually on the N64. When you talk about games that, like, pull the most power,
that's one of them,
from a system. I mean, they squeezed every single possible ounce of power out of the N64, but it's just GoldenEye's got that 007 license.
Yeah, the license could be very powerful. The James Bond is a very popular thing globally, like that. But even so, just the idea, like, even if it wasn't like the best Bond stuff for that game, just the fact that they were able to recreate some of those scenes from the movie, because at the time it was so popular back then, like, in the way that they did it, and it was actually good for a lot of people, that's what made that game. And then everything else just compounded upon it.
Yeah. And then the multiplayer, you get to play as like Baron Samedi and
Oddjob.
Dino plays Oddjob. I guess they initially, one of the things they wanted was to actually have different versions of Bond.
Exactly. I was just going to say.
Yeah, they couldn't pull it off.
There's a licensing thing, but it would have been cool because then you would have been able to play as like your favorite Bond between all the ones up to that point up with Brosnan. And I think that would have been sweet. I wish they actually made a better effort to do that, because I think if now these days, I think we could see something like that happen more, like actually like
easily
come to fruition compared to back then. Because back then, a lot of it had to do with, you know, the way that games were looked at as an art form and as a marketing tool for a lot of things. And then keep in mind, like, a lot of people back then that just didn't understand games the way that they do now, especially like people like Sean Connery or Roger Moore, even back then, like, it's just a lot of stuff with it.
Yeah. Gaming was a huge industry, but it's not like it is today. I mean,
it's not as respected as it is now.
Yeah. Who's your favorite Bond?
My favorite, because it's hard, because my Bond is Pierce Brosnan, because that's the Bond I grew up with.
Right.
Even though I know Sean Connery is the GOAT, and he's always been the GOAT. One who I always thought was like really highly underrated, and it's not even his fault, Timothy Dalton, because I feel like he had some really good elements to his Bond that just get overshadowed by everything else.
He was actually supposed to be the Bond for GoldenEye, and they were supposed to do it a couple years. And I kind of look at it now, and I'm like, yeah, Timothy Dalton would have been really good. My favorite Bond is actually Roger Moore.
He's a funny Bond, but he's a classy, stylish Bond.
Yeah, like, I don't know why. I've just always. It's just he's always.
And the funny thing is, there's no right answer to this, because everybody like debates about this all the time. It's like the cool thing about all the different Bonds, unlike like all the different Batmans and like a lot of other people that play Superman, so all the different Bonds have something unique and like awesome about them that makes them stand out from their era. Like, because Sean Connery, you can say what you want. Sean Connery started the role, but he did so many movies as Bond that did stuff for that character that actually were like things that started off that bled over into the other Bonds afterwards, like that. Yeah. But then you can say the same thing about Roger Moore. Roger Moore, I felt like he was not only the funny Bond where he had a good sense of humor, but he was all about class. And then Dalton was a little bit more brutal, the brutality of Bond from the Ian Fleming books. And then Pierce Brosnan is like a blending of like everything but made for the 90s, like that type of Bond. Like, it was just so many good things.
And some of the guys who've done more, you know, they have good movies and like bad movies. Like, not all of Sean Connery's movies. Bond.
Oh no, he's got stinkers.
Like, he's got
Thunderball.
I mean, Die Another Day to me is like absolute trash. But I still think, and you know, some people will say, oh, it's because you guys are gamers, you're fans of the game. But I still argue to this day that GoldenEye is the best Bond movie. I think it is a lot of Bond movies. When you sort of look at things, like, some of them have like some things that like some aspects that are really good. Like, sometimes the gadgets are too over the top. Sometimes the gadgets are just too basic. It's like, no, Bond. And so I still to this day feel like GoldenEye is like the perfect blend.
It's like a good medium.
Like, it's the good medium of everything. And it's Pierce Brosnan's first one, and he's like just
so, he knocks it out of the park. He's a dope Bond in that movie. Yeah. Like he's good. I think
he's
got
good
better.
He's good. Yeah, he's good in his three movies. And then Die Another Day was just like,
it's just like, bleh.
It's just like afterwards. It's just, Halle Berry's not a Bond girl. It's like, I'm out, you know, like, but I'm not dissing Halle Berry. She's just not a Bond girl.
We love Halle Berry, but like that movie, you guys got to understand, they got Madonna to do the music for, which wouldn't be a big deal, but then she wanted a part in the movie. It's like, come on now. Like, this is becoming more of a marketing movie than it is a Bond movie.
Yeah. Oh, Crazy. Okay. All right. Well, hey, man. That's great. So much fun talking to you. Glad we got to make this happen. So much fun. So, hey, where can people find you on the internet?
I am literally everywhere. You could find me on YouTube, youtube.com/@JakeJamesLugo, because I know YouTube is using the tags now. You can find me on Twitter @JakeJamesLugo. You can find me on TikTok @JakeJamesLugo. I'm also on Instagram @JakeJamesLugo as well. And then you could also find me on Patreon, patreon.com/JakeJamesLugo. I put exclusive content on there that you're not going to find on YouTube or anywhere else, but I also give early access to a lot of my stuff, a lot of my video reviews, a lot of my other content. I'm posting literally almost every day on TikTok at this point. I'm posting all the time on Twitter and on Instagram, like sharing stuff around. It's just keeping the conversation about games going with everybody all over the place. So check it out, follow on there, show some love. And again, trust me, you'll find something that you'll get a kick out of.
Yeah, no, it's great. You're doing new stuff, you're doing retro stuff, all the stuff. It's absolutely great. So awesome. So much fun. Glad we could make this happen. So
of course,
guys, remember you can find me anywhere on the internet @SuperGainsBros, and of course right here on the Box Trick Podcast. So with that, as always, guys, thank you for watching, thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.